Oh, yes. Anna's reminding me I should say something about my book, Making America Great Again. Actually, that title is, there's a phrase in the book where I use that title, that some people want to make America great again. For some, it's a fairy tale. Others, it's a horror story. So that phrase, some of you know Brian McLaren, right? He read my book, my manuscript, and he said that should be the title, because that was not the original title. But as we talked about it, he explained that it would have broader appeal, and that he said that it's a gift. What you're writing, this title is being given to you. So I agreed, because that was not the original title. Yeah, it is a personal memoir, and it is a critique of Christian Western supremacy. And I don't know what else I should or can say. I'm hoping in 2.5 months. Yes. 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 I hope so. I'm a local author, so I think that they lean towards local. I will go by. Making America Great Again. Okay.
We can do better, but we're already clear.
Well, I think I might write about that too. I'm going to close. Pardon? Red hats. So we, the first half we ended talking about communion again, and I just thought of something that I'm experiencing right now. Last month. Do you know Rabbi Arthur Gross Schaefer?
Yeah.
Okay, so he brought a group over to our Sunday service, and we have communion every Sunday, but we didn't because they were bringing bagels and lox and cream cheese, and so we thought that would be our communion. And we're doing it again next month. It shows what Arthur and I think of each other, that he feels safe to come and to bring people. And we're not sure, but we penciled in the 19th, which is Palm Sunday. Arthur has been such a friend to me. I could talk the rest of my time about Arthur and our friendship, but I won't do that because that's not why I'm here. Invite me back and I'll talk about maybe that. But I honestly feel like... I was going to say, if you want your communion to really be communion, you got to get people who are really different. That's what makes it the Lord's Supper. That's what makes it... All right? So... I'm really amazed that Arthur's willing to do this, and that the people who come with him just get right in and celebrate with us on Sunday morning. And I honestly feel that even though we're Christians and they're not, I feel a greater bond with him and with them than I do with many Christians. And the example that I use in my book is I have actually 8 siblings. I'm the oldest of 8. And I am fortunate enough to be able to have... relationship with all of them, because I know that, as you know, there are many people who have a brother or sister they'll never speak to again. And so I say, for those people, their real family is not their family, it's someone else. And I say, in in Christianity, it's much the same way, that many of my real family is not constituted by Christians. Because we don't have time for each other. We don't see each other as fully human. So what I wanted to move on to for these next few minutes, there's something that over the past few months I've been trying to understand, and I've come to a place where I'm beginning to understand it, but it was a nut I couldn't crack. It's what I call a disorder of territoriality. Whereas this sense in our ecosystem, if you will, of white ownership. For instance, Richard Allen left that Methodist Episcopal Church. Why did the whites own that? Why wasn't it everybody's church? Why could they be asked to go sit somewhere else if it's everybody's church? So this disorder of territoriality has something to do with our settler colonialism. This presumption that whites own things. And it makes everybody else feel like interlopers. It makes us feel like we are trespassers. And it's the very thing that happened with Trayvon Martin 5 years ago. 5 years and 2 weeks ago, actually. Trayvon Martin left where he was living during the halftime show of the NBA All-Star Game. He was a Floridian, and he loved the Miami Heat, especially LeBron James, who played for the Heat at that time. And he thought he could get to a convenience store to get a snack before the second half began. But as you know, he never made it home. He was presumed to be an interloper by George Zimmerman. But that's not the only example. 3 months ago, I visited the people of the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota, who are being violated on their own land. There is a presumption by the Energy Transfer Partners oil conglomerate that because they're oil, they can do whatever they want. There, again, it's what I call a disorder of territoriality, a sense of entitlement to ownership. It's what fortifies the idea that we should build a wall on the southern border across land that we gained illicitly as a country to protect something that really legally shouldn't even be ours. So we say that we are a nation of laws, and we really like to project that. We're a nation of laws. But it always begs the question, whose laws? You know, I mean, ask Rosa Parks, right? Okay, so whose laws, and who gets to participate in creating these laws? Well, this disorder also, I think, is behind the man who 3 weeks ago in Kansas pulled out a gun and shot two Indians, one of them an American citizen, one of them being killed, and just before he shot him, he said, "Get out of my country." And so what happens in this country is that people of color feel unwelcome in our own country. Whether it's standing in line at a bank or on a university campus, wherever we go, we feel there's, even if it's not overt, because it's the mood of the culture, it's because of our history, because of our experience, because of our parents' experiences and our grandparents' experiences, we know that the character of our country is dismissive about us and sees us as inconveniences. Not realizing the contributions, thus you have hidden figures. Not realizing and celebrating the contributions that we make. So this disorder, because that's all I could frame it as an obsession with owning, which I think is why people are so into Donald Trump. Because, I mean, he's associated with many things. He's associated with neckties and vodka and, you know, who knows what. But mostly he's associated with real estate. With empire. And that's so appealing to some people. And it has flipped the switch of what is called nativism. Now, the ironic thing is that the people who are feeling nativistic aren't even natives. But that's what it's called. Right? I mean, there's a little more justifiability in Europe, perhaps. But on this continent, if you are a true native, you almost have to chuckle if it didn't hurt so much. So many times we recognize as people of color that we have to prove our deserving of being present, really of being alive, of our very existence has to be justified. And so many of us, going back to what Anna was asking earlier, so many of us think that in order to justify our existence, we have to be white too. Because white is what's accepted. And so some people do that. But then there are other people who know that no matter what they do, they'll never be white. They can't. They can't. They don't have enough background. They don't have enough training to be white. I can be white, and I can fool myself that I am. And one of the reasons is that I grew up in a very white world, and because of that, it's not something that's daunting or intimidating to me, because I just grew up going to schools that were predominantly white. I mean, there was a season where I was going to school that was only African American as a kid, so I'm conversant. I know how to talk the talk, you know, that kind of thing. Talk white. Yeah, I know how to do that. The thing is that I'm aware enough to not give in to that. And in fact, in my book, I make this point because when I came to Santa Barbara, I became very much part of the white evangelical world. And the political scene, everything that you would, you know, associate with white evangelicalism. And in my book, I make this statement. I said, I could have been a good white evangelical. Except for those damn questions I kept having in my mind. Get the book. Yeah, so this disorder of territoriality, I truly wanted to get to the bottom of it. I haven't totally, but I'm beginning to find something satisfactory for me. And it didn't happen until maybe a week ago that I began to unpack this in a way that satisfies me somewhat. And it was after reading this chapter. So Saul is the king of Israel, and he's chasing David everywhere. All throughout the wilderness, he's trying to find David so he can kill David. He's intimidated by David. He's threatened by David. So let's read this. After Saul returned from fighting the Philistines, he was told that David had gone into the wilderness of En-Gedi. So Saul chose 3,000 elite troops from all Israel and went to search for David and his men near the rocks of the wild goats. At the place where the road passes some sheepfold, Saul went into a cave to relieve himself. But as it happened, David and his men were hiding farther back in that very cave. Now's your opportunity, David's men whispered to him. Today the Lord is telling you, I will certainly put your enemy into your power to do with as you wish. So David crept forward and cut off a piece of the hem of Saul's robe. But then David's conscience began bothering him because he had cut Saul's robe. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this to my lord the king. I shouldn't attack the Lord's anointed one, for the Lord himself has chosen him. So David restrained his men and did not let them kill Saul. After Saul had left the cave and gone on his way, David came out and shouted after him, my lord the king! And when Saul looked around, David bowed low before him. Then he shouted to Saul, why do you listen to the people who say, I am trying to harm you? This very day you can see with your own eyes it isn't true, for the Lord placed you at my mercy back there in the cave. Some of my men told me to kill you, but I spared you, for I said, I will never harm the king. He is the Lord's anointed one. Look, my father, at what I have in my hand. It is a piece of the hem of your robe. I cut it off, but I didn't kill you. This proves that I am not trying to harm you, and that I have not sinned against you, even though you have been hunting for me to kill me. May the Lord judge between us. Perhaps the Lord will punish you for what you were trying to do to me, but I will never harm you. And then, right after this, David, in this exchange, David says to Saul, who am I but a dead dog or a flea that the king should come and chase me? In other words, David is mystified over how he poses a threat when he is a lone man with some friends and he's traveling with his aged parents in the wilderness trying to save everybody's life, and the king is armed with his troops and he sits on the throne of the nation and he's trying to figure out, why are you doing this? It doesn't make sense. But it's an obsession that Saul has. His obsession is that David is a threat. Now, of course, it's not groundless, because Samuel the prophet has already told Saul that the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel and raised up another, a man according to his a man after his own heart. So Saul is aware of that. But this jealousy just grows in Saul. You know, especially after the parade, right, when the people are singing, David has slain, Saul has slain his thousands and David his ten thousands. I mean, that really provokes him. And he's threatened by it. And he can't imagine not having the power. The problem is he's haunted by the spectacle that the power could be not bequeathed to his own son. The dynasty is going to end. He's threatened by this. So he feels like he can fight, which goes back to what I was reading from Simone about illicit power. So I started to see that I started to understand better this, why, because let's say that you're an immigrant, that you came from south of the border, and you just want to get a college education, or you just want to pick avocados. You just want to live. You just want to have a safer environment for your children, a more hopeful environment for your children. And then you're looked at as a national security threat, and you're thinking, I'm just a flea. I'm just a dead dog. Why are you threatened by me? But we have fluffed up this idea in our country that they are the threat to civilization. That these people who are using their blowers to clear out the dust from our yards, that these people who are making our sushi, because you know Japanese people in Santa Barbara don't make sushi. You know that, right? I know, it's one of those things. But Latin Americans do everything. And they're just like anybody else, trying to survive, trying to make a better life. But they're being cast as a threat. And we find ourselves tempted to believe that they are a threat. that they're taking our jobs from us. Yeah, we really believe that. And so we, not only them, but anybody who is other than white American, is taking our jobs from us. So why is it that the Chinese are stealing our jobs? How can the Chinese steal our jobs if we don't give it to them? Yeah. But we don't want to point the finger at the U.S. It has to be the other. So what helped me begin to understand this obsession that Saul has, he feels like power could get away from him. And he's haunted. It's a spectacle. Remember just a few months ago, Colin Kaepernick? All right? San Francisco 49ers, okay, so when the national anthem is playing, he's going to take a knee. All right? He had done that for two games before the media decided, we're going to make a big deal over this. And it was just a completely quiet, he wasn't even on the front line with his teammates. He was behind his teammates, sitting down on the bench. They decided they were going to make a big story out of this. So then it raises the question, well, you know, and you saw probably in the papers things like people burning his jersey and telling him, I mean, he got death threats. And it's what it is, we see it as they're threatened that somebody is not honoring what they own. They own the anthem. They own the flag. Why can't it be Colin Kaepernick's flag? Why can't he demonstrate protest because he understands the worth of that flag and that anthem and make a statement? But because he doesn't possess it, he doesn't own it, he doesn't have title to it. Just like Richard Allen and his people didn't have title to the Methodist Church. They're seen as outsiders and therefore trespassers, interlopers, violators. Well, David was seen that way by Saul. But not just because he was a trespasser. It's the threat part that becomes problematic. David is perceived as a threat to his power. And when people become white Americans, people who are other are seen as not just other, but as threats to the power, to the possessions, to our way of life. And so we constantly find ourselves under psychological warfare, if you will, to justify our existence. So then, after the election, we hear so many people, and I got to tell you, I'm not the only one, but as a person of color, we're amazed at how many white people are interested in talking about justice. Wow! Who knew? And remember that big women's march all over the country and in Santa Barbara? And we were like, wow, this is pretty amazing. They're white people. And they're concerned. And I remember at De La Guerra Plaza, I was there and I was given a chance to say something to the remaining crowd. And I said, you know, I know that there aren't that many African Americans in Santa Barbara, but we are sorely underrepresented in this march. And I think I know why. Because we are still skeptical of white people, even when they're progressive. Because it seems to be at their convenience. And they have not really bought into the struggle. And there's a professor at UC Riverside, Ashen Crawley, who said, reading some of these doomsday think pieces, I suspect some self-branded leftists get pleasure from elaborating worst-case scenarios. This sort of muffled glee And by the way, Ashen is African American. This sort of muffled glee from talking about how they were right about everything from the beginning. No, no, no. 45's administration isn't full of novices, but really serious and sinister and smart people, and y'all aren't ready for fascism, they imply. I think the more grotesque and absurd 45's actions, the more pleasure they get from telling us how bad things will be. The stuff I'm reading isn't about knowledge with the purpose of confronting and alleviating harm, but about spreading discomfort. And it's almost a shaming. Why didn't you think it'd be bad? How could you not know? This is the kind of moralizing that's happening, because they want to style themselves as the ones with the real knowledge of what's actually happening. It's quite vulgar. And then he says this. This is why minoritarian knowledge is so important. Not only because we emerged from traditions of resisting this shit since 1492, but also because we have had to imagine and thus materially implement alternatives to normative order as a way of life. Doomsday narratives emerge as pleasurable when you don't pay attention to the indigenous and black and Latinx and queer and women knowledges. So, we have just 5 minutes for anybody to reply.
It would be nice if we could perpetuate the color blindness of children and change society's attitudes. I don't think territoriality is a disorder. It's we're hardwired for it. All mammals have territoriality, and it's part of their survival instinct. You know, tens of thousands of years ago, there were human tribes, and everybody else was an outsider, and that's how they survived. So I'm not trying to justify territoriality. I'm just saying if we're going to deal with it, we got to look at the fact that we're hardwired for it, and we got to change attitudes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm out of line here, but I would like to ask you to comment on the difference in the black person who's brought up in the British colonies. I myself was born in St. Kitts in the West Indies. And I perceive a great deal of difference in my experience.
Yeah.
And I think that myth of the city upon the hill, you know, was claimed by the white person in the United States.
Yeah.
And until we decide we don't need to live up on a hill, there's going to be no difference. But what I want to say is I want to thank you, because I think being born in South Africa is different. We can see Noah Trevor Noah.
Mm-hmm.
Noah. He is a different person. I don't know if anybody could get the U.S. Colloquialisms as fast as that man did.
Yeah.
And he was born up in great poverty in South Africa.
Yeah.
Just comment on especially the difference in the British colonial black experience and the white colonial black experience. Because in both cases, there were slaves at some stage.
Yes.
But there's an enormous difference in my experience.
Yes, there is a difference. And one of the differences that we see manifested in this country, because that's where we can really see the contrast. We see the difference simply as this. Those colonies have been autonomous, and they've seen African leaders. They have managed. Yes, and that's what the difference is. Because since then, the migration that has taken place, when people move here from the Bahamas or Jamaica, they tend to be the best represented business people among Africans in this country. And it's because they have not been psychologically crippled like many of us because of generations of not having that opportunity, not seeing our own people taking roles of leadership in every part of society. So yeah, you're right, there is a difference. And you mentioned Trevor Noah. He is a remarkable, he's a brilliant person. I actually cite him in my book. He is brilliant. He speaks Swiss, German, multiple South African languages and Japanese. And he has a grasp of the world that few people have. Yeah, that's pretty neat.
I just wanted to, in light of what you've been talking about, I talked about the Trinity series last week, and I'd like to point out two to you. This Tuesday night, from 6:30 to 8, there will be a facilitated training session on the role of white people in eliminating racism and other oppressions. So I think that might be very interesting for us to find out what can we actually do about this. And then on April 2nd, on Sunday morning at 11:30, there'll be a visit from Black Lives Matter Santa Barbara. And one of our parishioners actually heads this.
Simone.
Yeah. And it will be working for the validity of black lives and to rebuild the black liberation movement. So I would greatly invite you to these things. The flyers are back on the table. And I think, you know, it's all well and good to hear these things, but at some point we need to do something.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And my time is up. I'll close by making this, now that you brought that up, by just noting that one of the ways that this, what I have been so confused by this territoriality that excludes people of color, became very stark for me when, after Trayvon Martin was shot, a group of people, mostly Californians, started what we now know as Black Lives Matter. What really was amazing to me is how many people were offended by that simple statement. Just couldn't deal with it. They said, well, don't all lives matter? Well, we're not saying that all lives don't matter. We're just focusing on the fact that, yes, but we are endangered as a species, if you will. And so that's what we're saying, is that our lives are worth living. But to see the outrage over that was very, very concerning for me. Anyway, thank you all for your time. I appreciate it. You've been great.